We turn now to the ongoing humanitarian crisis taking place along our southern border. As thousands of child migrants make their way across the U.S. border from Central America, President Obama visited Texas Governor Rick Perry on Wednesday to discuss Obama's proposal for additional funding from Congress to address the situation. But congressional Republicans are calling for more than just money.
The number one message to stop this is planes arriving in Honduras and Guatemala with these children back home. That sends the message.
And Thursday, the United Nations announced what might be a change in messaging. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees wants the United States and Mexico to recognize the children as refugees, saying that those from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras should not be forced to return home where they will be subject to persecution. A lot of you think there's a limit to what the U.S. can do.
So many here say, don't take. Well, I think the people that are just saying don't take are not looking worldwide as to what America looks like when we say that.
On our Facebook page, Maria calls on her fellow citizens to find a little compassion. It bothers me that these distinctions matter so much. The implication is that they deserve sympathy if they are refugees, but not if they are just illegal immigrants. But they are clearly refugees. No one wants to send children out in the world like that unless there's a compelling reason. What is the distinction between being a refugee and being an immigrant? And what do these terms mean, both legally and politically, for the young kids crossing the border? For answers, we turn now to David Simmons, adjunct professor of law at the University of Denver, and Jana Mason, senior advisor for external affairs for the United Nations Refugee Agency. Mason says it's all about selecting which cases are obvious refugees and which are not.
We think that some percentage, still unknown, but some percentage of these individuals, these children, could be refugees, could be fleeing the grounds that would give rise to a refugee claim. We do recognize this is a complex migration phenomenon. It's what we call a mixed migration situation. People are fleeing this region for a whole host of reasons. Some of them, of course, just because of the absolute abject poverty that's going on down in that region. Some of them, unfortunately, children are being trafficked because of the growing influence of trafficking networks. Some of them may have the desire to join family in other countries. And some of them, quite a number of them we know from interviews, are fleeing violence. Some kids we talked to said they could barely get from one end of town to the other without experiencing some sort of violent episode. So in cases where individuals are fleeing violence and there's some element of it that is tied to persecution, but some of these individuals may meet the refugee definition. We don't know how many that would be. That would be up to U.S. government adjudicators to determine. What we're asking for is that they be given a chance to tell their story so that someone can make that decision.
And your interest is purely in the motivations and the circumstances of their departure from the country and your concern with the political stalemates in the United States and the way in which we view migrants in the United States is immaterial. And that would be normal in your case. Right, Jana?
Yeah, I think what we're trying to do is change the narrative a little bit. I mean, it's unfortunate that this whole thing, because of the timing, because of the politics, has gotten caught up in the broader immigration reform debate. Obviously, that's an important debate to have, but all the focus is on the extent to which this is tied in with U.S. immigration policies. And we don't think there's been quite enough focus on what is it that's compelling these kids to leave, regardless of where they decide to go, regardless of how they get there. What is it that's driving them even from their homes? Because most people don't leave their homes for no reason. So we're hoping that everyone can look a little bit deeply into the source of the violence, the nature of what's going down there, so that we can make the case that these children, if they need it, should have access to a process to determine if they're entitled to refugee protection. If they're not, if they don't meet that definition, we fully understand, then they're subject to normal U.S. deportation or removal procedures.
All right, David Simmons stipulating now, and you're an adjunct professor of law at the University of Denver, stipulating for the moment that the motivations that might qualify these individuals as refugees under U.N. definitions might differ under the definitions in the United States. How do you see the legal distinction between refugee status and any other status that the U.S. government might be considering here?
Well, the United States government has, since 1980, recognized the international definition of a refugee, both in the way that we designate people to come to the United States as refugees and the way we treat people who are already in the United States who are allowed to apply for political asylum. The factors are very similar. We're looking at whether or not these individuals, these children in this case, are suffering persecution for the grounds that Ms. Mason was discussing. And then we have a process in the United States through either the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Justice to evaluate those cases.
Do you think that the U.S. government is trying to speak out of both sides of their mouth here regarding the definition of refugee status here? Certainly there have been special cases in U.S. law down through history, the way we treat Cubans, the way we might treat people from other countries, whether they're refugees or whether they are designated as, you know, economic migrants?
Absolutely. The executive branch does have the ability to designate groups of individuals as refugees, and as you noted, that has been done in the past. It could be done in a case like this. But typically a refugee designation applies to individuals who are outside of the United States. Once they get to the United States, the mechanism is to apply for political asylum. We definitely have a humanitarian crisis, and my fear as an immigration attorney and as a law professor is that we're looking at something similar to what happened before the Second World War with the SS St. Louis, where a group of individuals fled Nazi Germany and tried to get to a safe haven in the United States. There was no mechanism to really let them into the United States. They ended up going back to the Netherlands, and most of them were captured by the Nazis when they invaded the Netherlands and subsequently killed in concentration camps. Obviously, this isn't quite that situation, but we have a compelling humanitarian crisis. So we have a government at this point that's not really prepared to adequately address what we do in this situation.
So, whoa, I mean, you are literally comparing this situation here to the kind of bureaucratic sort of holdup that resulted in the deaths of Jews during the Holocaust. Obviously, you made a distinction there, but the same reasons for the holdup would make this situation comparable to what happened on the St. Louis?
Well, I certainly hope that the results aren't the same, but the manifestations of the problem are very similar. We have a bureaucratic system that does not have a mechanism in place to deal with the crisis. The government is taking what actions it deems necessary, but at this point, I don't think anybody's standing back from this situation other than in crisis management mode and looking at either the driving factors that Ms. Mason talked about, or, you know, frankly, how we come across as a culture and how we come across as a society in dealing with this situation.
Jana, I'm frankly tempted to put you on the spot here. Do you agree with what David Simmons is saying, that this is reminiscent of the kind of bureaucratic stalemate that resulted in the deaths of individuals during the Holocaust?
Well, actually, I can get off the spot because the situation is quite different in the way it's playing out. As David explained earlier, there's a process to admit refugees directly from overseas, and then there's the asylum process, which is very individualized in nature. So what's happening now at our borders doesn't require a group designation. All it requires is that once people get to the border, once they enter the U.S., that they're allowed to make an individual determination. And we recognize that the numbers are massive and they're overwhelming the existing ability of the U.S. authorities to deal with them right now. We're very sympathetic to that. But some people are saying, oh, these kids will stay here forever. Well, we know from our experience that the U.S. has, you know, a very well-developed asylum adjudication system, and that when done right, it doesn't have to take forever. It won't take years. It won't take months. It doesn't even have to take, you know, weeks to get at the heart of the matter of why these kids are fleeing. But we know that it can't be done in summary fashion at the border with traumatized children who are still basically shell-shocked from what they've just gone through. You can't take a 7-year-old and say, tell us your story right away. Are you a refugee? So it's going to take a little bit of time. But if there are enough resources devoted to it, they can make these adjudications in a quick enough fashion to decide who needs protection, who needs to stay in the U.S., and who can be returned to their countries.
All right. So, you know, maybe we're making a mountain over a molehill regarding refugee versus immigrant or migrant here. But for both of you, what would reassure you that the U.S. is on a course that would be consistent with the humanitarian principles that matter most to you at the United Nations and that matter most to you as an attorney, David Simmons? Jana, you first.
From the UN HCR, UN Refugee Agency perspective, all that we're looking for is assurances that no child or adults, if they happen to be part of the population, will be immediately or summarily sent back without what we would consider a full and fair chance to tell their story. It doesn't have to drag out for a long time. As long as they interview these children, really look deeply into why they're fleeing, and for those that would fear persecution if returned, that they're given a chance then to be granted asylum.
David Simmons, as an attorney, how confident are you that the U.S. has such a process and that they will use it consistent with the humanitarian norms that would keep us from comparing this, as you did, to the situation during the Holocaust?
I'm somewhat confident. I agree with Ms. Mason. There is an asylum procedure that is in place. It is a procedure that doesn't have to take a tremendous amount of time. What I am concerned about is that what we've seen so far is an insistence on placing these children in any location, regardless of whether they have access to an immigration court, regardless of whether they have access to legal counsel, which in my opinion is crucial to any fair adjudication of whether or not an individual qualifies for political asylum. This is not a touchy-feely humanitarian remedy we're talking about. It is a technical legal remedy with 40 years of jurisprudence, sometimes contradictory, behind it. What I'm afraid I'm seeing with this administration is an emphasis on bureaucratic convenience and a lower level of concern for the due process rights of the children.
Jana Mason and David Simmons, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jana Mason is the Senior Advisor for External Affairs at the United Nations, and David Simmons is Adjunct Professor of Law at the University of Denver.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.